Where I wanted to start is my topic is the privatization of public health. Full disclosure, my slides are not nearly as good as Ben's slides, so you'll have to not be as, they're not quite as visually interesting. You're going to see a lot of these blank screens, unfortunately. But what I will be talking about today is a project that I've been thinking about and working on, although it is also still kind of in its formative stages, in thinking about how privatization is affecting public health practice, public health institutions, and what that mean, what these trends, to the extent that they are trends, mean for how we think about public health in general, and how we think about how institutions and what institutions should be involved in trying to protect and provide public health services. So I wanted to just start with a little bit of background and context. When we think about public health institutions in particular, and even if we broaden it out and think about government institutions, you know, most of our public health institutions are based in a government agency or are at least largely directed by government agencies, and whether that be at the national, state, or local level here in the U.S., or even, you know, public health institutions at the international level that are engaged in different aspects of trying to advance public health. And here in the United States, we've seen a trend really over the last 40 years or so of either gradual or in some cases very sudden reconfigurations of how our government services are provided. Sometimes it's a response to the ideologies of the people in political power. Sometimes these changes are a result of responding to crisis. And the example I'm going to talk about in detail in a few minutes, which focuses on what happened in Detroit over the last couple of years with regard to public health services, was largely a response to economic crisis for the economic downturn that happened beginning in 2008. But the overall context here is that we've seen increasing privatization of government services in general. We've seen a lot of things that were historically handled by a government agency being delegated, being contracted out to private entities. And when I say private entities, I'm not only talking about for-profit companies, although sometimes that is who is taking over some of these responsibilities, but also nonprofit organizations as well. And so you have some decentralization, devolution of responsibility to these parties, sometimes through a contractual process, sometimes just through partnerships to provide services. In many cases, these outside parties have expertise that the agency itself doesn't have, in part because of limitations on budget and other capabilities. And in some cases, privatization occurs because an agency decides that it can no longer offer certain services, or decides explicitly not to add services and lets private entities handle them instead to cover that aspect of public health outreach. And as I said, you know, we also see governmental entities in some cases competing with or explicitly working in the same realms as private entities. And one question that came up when I first started thinking about this was, well, is this a, you know, my sense is that this is a trend that is increasing, that more and more public health services are being privatized. But unfortunately, there's not really a lot of great data about this. It's a lot of anecdotal data. There are a few studies. The best study I found was actually done nearly 15 years ago, and was a fairly thorough look at a lot of local public health agencies to see to what extent they were contracting out services to private entities. And so one big gap, and one that I hope to be able to fill as this project moves forward, is trying to get a better sense of to what extent this is really going on. When we think about privatization, this is sort of a new or underexplored discussion in the public health realm, but it's been widely explored in other areas where public goods are at stake. And so there's been extensive discussion and debate, both theoretical and practical, about privatization in the context of public education, where you know, there's been quite a lot of movement at state and local levels to take funds that would have gone to public schools and allocated them towards non-public schools, in some cases charter, in some cases private schools, and we've also seen this happen with prisons, and you know, a lot of prisons are now privatized, And my initial starting point was, well, privatization of public goods has some potential benefits, and the advocates for privatization often cite these benefits. It might be more cost effective because you can, in some cases, have economies of scale that you can't have in an agency setting. Or you might have less restrictions on how you provide the services or what government requirements you have to adhere to. Now, that's not necessarily an advantage, as I'll come to in a moment. But there might be efficiency, there might be greater effectiveness if the private entity has expertise that the public entity does not or cannot develop sufficiently. In some cases, having something privatized might make it more flexible. Flexibility in the institutional structure or flexibility in adapting to new challenges because the private entity might be able to be a little bit more nimble. Some proponents of privatization have said, well, it allows you to give greater incentives and develop a workforce, incentives for professional development that you can't necessarily have inside an agency, although I don't know if that's necessarily a given. And primarily, it's driven by political factors. So, shrinking the size of government, trying to, either for ideological reasons or otherwise, it might just be a belief that a market-based approach is going to be more effective in achieving goals. Now, all of these potential arguments in favor of privatization have downsides, and some of them are very significant downsides. The cost isn't a given, and sometimes outsourcing or privatizing certain services are going to lead to a greater degree of cost because you have to deal with multiple levels of private entities who are contributing to your services. There's also a greater level of management. The survey I was referring to before, which studied a lot of local public health agencies, found that one of the big changes was that the people in the agencies spent their time managing these private entities and making sure they were actually achieving what they needed to, and less time actually providing public health services. And so they became more of a management entity rather than a public health service entity. It's questionable whether privatization is going to lead to better effectiveness. And one of the significant downsides is that you don't have the same level of accountability and oversight, particularly democratic oversight, that you get from a public agency. There are questions about legal authority, and there are also questions about whether entities in the private sector or engaging in privatized provision of public health services are going to really be trying to achieve the same goals and meet the same obligations or have the same incentives as a public agency would. And this brings me to my case study. This is the issue that really kind of brought this to my mind and started me down the path of thinking about this. I live in Detroit, and as some of you probably know, Detroit has been through quite a lot of economic and financial difficulty in recent years. Obviously, the downturn affected many places around the country and around the world very significantly, economic downturn in 2008. But in Detroit, it sort of culminated in a very unusual level of crisis because the city government itself had been mismanaged and their finances had been mismanaged for many years. The city had to file bankruptcy in 2013. The state imposed through a piece of state legislation that has been challenged multiple times now, an emergency manager on the city, effectively removing its elected government and imposing an appointed emergency manager who had control over all of the budgetary decisions that the city made. And so even though there were still elected officials in place, a mayor and a city council, they essentially had their political power removed for a period of time while this emergency manager was in place. And it led to some very strange and problematic outcomes in some senses. It also led to, in some versions of the story, some good outcomes as well. I mean, the city emerged from bankruptcy very quickly, and so the question is at what cost? And how does this relate to the privatization story I was telling before? Well, a lot of people think of Detroit, they think of things like this, like the spectacular ruins of the Michigan Central Station. It doesn't look quite as bad anymore. They're starting to put windows back in, which is a good sign, or the Packard plant. But when I think of Detroit, I think of things like this, the Guardian building, beautiful Art Deco building downtown, beautiful skyline, and the Detroit Institute of Arts, which is one of the best art museums in the country or in the world. Now, one of the big debates when the city went into a financial crisis was, well, how do we meet all of the obligations? There are obligations to city pensioners. There are obligations to keep the operations of the city running. And among the things that were proposed were, you know, selling off all the art and trying to use that to pay off the obligations. Eventually, they managed a way to find a way to not do that. But one of the things on the chopping block when they were trying to cut costs in 2012 was the Detroit Department of Health and Wellness Promotion. This is the city health department. And in the budget for the 2012-13 fiscal year, the city government, the mayor, decided that to zero out funding for the health department and pretty much said, well, you're on your own, figure something out. You know, obviously you still have to keep operating because we still have public health concerns and we still need this institution to function in some way. And so what they came up with was they created something called the Institute for Population Health, which was a nonprofit entity, nonprofit institute that, and essentially what the plan was to take virtually the entire operations of the city health department and outsource it to this institute. And a lot of the funding for the city health department had come from the state government and also from federal grants. And so those funding sources were contracted directly to this institute, bypassing the city health department, also incidentally bypassing any kind of direct oversight from the city council for approving budgetary expenditures, and also incidentally by dissolving or by getting rid of most of the staff of the health department, allowing for or avoiding some of the obligations that were required under city contracting rules and employment rules. So pensions, benefits, and other kind of types of things that were required by the city. What ended up happening is most of the people in the city health department were laid off, and then most of them were rehired by this institute, but with a different benefits package and different no pensions and that sort of thing. So that's a whole other concerning issue about how this was done. When I first heard about this, I managed to get in touch with some of the leadership at the city health department, and to my surprise, they were very candid and open about why they were doing this. I mean, they said, you know, we think this is the only way we can continue operating in this environment. The city's not going to give us any funding at all. This was the best way to efficiently use the money that we had, and it's essentially going to be most of the same people, but they're going to be operating in a different type of institution. And I said, well, what about your legal powers? You know, how can you can't outsource all of your public health powers to a nonprofit organization? And they said, oh, we're going to keep the health department in place. We're just going to have three employees. It's going to be the medical director, the health officer, and the assistant health officer, and who will retain the powers, and they'll just delegate them to these other people. And I said, well, as a public health lawyer, I'm not so sure that's going to work out, because what happens when you start getting challenges to enforcement actions and other things like that? They said, oh, well, our lawyers have looked at it and we think it's fine. Now, what's interesting is that after about a year of this going on, the city did do a full audit of the operations of this external nonprofit and determined that some of those legal powers were questionable. And even though there were not any legal challenges to the authority of the Institute for Population Health to enforce public health law that I'm aware of, I think that it was an area of significant vulnerability. The second area of significant vulnerability is that since there was very little direct accountability to the city government anymore, because it's one step removed, there was a lot of question as to whether the efficiencies and the effectiveness that was hoped to be gained by this outsourcing would actually come to pass. Now, in their first report that they generated at the end of the first year of being in place, so the Institute for Population Health found that on a lot of the major public health indicators in the city, there had been progress in the form of either increased participation or increased number of services provided. Not in all areas. There were some decreases in substance abuse and some other kinds of screening. But one of the things that is raised by this, you know, this was their initial assessment of themselves, On further review, what the city found was that, and this is hard to read, it's very small, but this was their report that was generated after the first year, that the transition of health services to the Institute for Population Health was not adequately planned, poorly managed, lacked internal controls. A lot of the legal aspects of this were not carefully executed. And what's happened since then is that what you've seen is that with new leadership coming on board in the city, they've now completely retrenched. They've moved the majority of the services, or are in the process of moving the majority of the services back into the city health department. They're staffing up again at the city health department, and they're moving forward with the traditional model of providing it in. I'm actually out of time, so I'm going to skip over my discussion of the water crisis in Detroit. But what I will say is that under the emergency manager and efforts to raise economize the water supply, there were mass shutoffs of water in the city for people who hadn't paid bills. It led to a big crisis and lots of protests, and actually some intervention by the UN rapporteur on the right to water to try to ensure that people had access to water. And you've recently seen some problems in Flint as well with an emergency manager making economic decisions that didn't take into account public health and resulting in some serious lead contamination in the water supply there. So privatization is kind of a mixed bag, and I have to confess, I really don't know exactly what my conclusion is. There are lots of problems, especially when you have large-scale privatization like you have with the Detroit City Health Department. At the same time, that particular situation might be a severe anomaly. There are very few departments who've done quite that level of privatization. And so as I move forward with this project, I hope to find out more and try to determine more carefully and more systematically how public health privatization might affect public health outcomes going forward. So thank you very much.